No question about it. We're all interested in dinosaurs. As a matter of fact, today in the United States, I think what we have is what we might call dinosaur mania. Now, one of the reasons perhaps this may have happened, you've had these traveling exhibits. They bring these creatures into the museums and, you know, they have these replicas of dinosaurs that move around and snort and things like that. In fact, is one of those exhibits visited us in San Diego. Of course, I took my grandchildren to see this marvelous exhibit. And I think that's created this great interest we have in dinosaurs today. So we want to talk about dinosaurs, their nature, their origin, their extinction, and some other things related to this fascinating subject of dinosaurs. Now, you may ask the question immediately, well, if God created dinosaurs, why don't we find the word dinosaur in the Bible? There seems to be no mention of dinosaurs in the Bible. Now, isn't that rather strange? Well, as a matter of fact, I do believe dinosaurs are described in the Bible. Now, we don't find the word dinosaur in the Bible. Now, the reason for that is quite simple. The Bible was translated into English about 1600, but the word dinosaur was not even invented until 1840. You see, people had forgotten all about dinosaurs until about 1830 when fossils of dinosaurs were discovered. And soon scientists realized that there was something very unusual here and very different. And some of them were very big. And so they finally realized that there were these creatures. The word dinosaur was invented by Sir Richard Owen, very famous British anatomist and paleontologist. He was a bitter opponent of Darwin, by the way. He was the one who invented the names. So, of course, we don't find the word dinosaur in the Bible. But I believe dinosaurs are described in the Bible. In Job chapter 40, we read about a creature called the behemoth. Now, this behemoth, a very unusual creature. He had bones like bars of iron. And he's so big, he just thinks he could drink up a river and wouldn't even have to hurry about it. And he had a tail like a cedar tree. Now, some have suggested perhaps the Bible was describing an elephant. Have you ever seen the tail of an elephant? Doesn't look like a cedar tree at all, does it? No, the Bible is not describing anything that looks like an elephant. I don't know of any elephant today that just thinks he's just so big he can drink up a river and doesn't have to hurry about it. But you know, that description seems to fit very well the description of a dinosaur. Now, if that's true, and I believe it is, then that means Job or his friends or his father or grandfather or great-grandfather had a living memory of dinosaurs and therefore were able to describe what we call dinosaurs. Now, the only way we find dinosaurs today, of course, are as fossils. We don't have any live dinosaurs. At least we don't have any in the San Diego Zoo. And although there's some stories that dinosaurs may be still, you know, maybe alive today in Africa, I doubt that very much. And I'll only believe it when we finally have a couple in the San Diego Zoo. But we do find their fossils. Do you know that fossils of dinosaurs have been found on every continent of the world? Been found on the subcontinent of Australia. They've been found on the north shore of Alaska and in Antarctica. Now, you can be sure that the evolutionists have a lot of fun trying to explain why there were dinosaurs on the north shore of Alaska or in Antarctica. Why, evolutionists believe that Alaska was even farther north when these dinosaurs existed than it is today. There we have several months of darkness, and very cold as it is in Antarctica. How could dinosaurs ever exist in a place like that? Well, we'll have more to say about that later. But you can see we find dinosaur fossils in many places around the world. In some cases are found in massive fossil graveyards. So we must start with their fossils. Now, actually, dinosaurs started out as eggs. We find fossil dinosaur eggs. We see a clutch of dinosaur eggs found in the Gobi Desert area of Mongolia. Fossil dinosaur eggs have been found in some of the states, the United States and Canada and many other countries of the world. And in some of these eggs, we actually find the fossilized embryo of the dinosaur. So we know that all dinosaurs started out as little fellows. But some of them ended up as being very big fellows. Now, this is the way that we find dinosaurs today, only as fossils. Now, this is a picture of an area in the Dinosaur National Monument in Vernal, Utah. We see this hillside. It's just full of these dinosaur bones. So that's the way we find dinosaurs today, just a mess in a rock, and that's what a fossil is. Now we have it all mixed up dinosaurs here, bones from various kinds of dinosaurs. Have you ever worked a jigsaw puzzle? Have all the pieces of one picture all mixed in together, and you have a picture to start with, don't you? What if you had the pieces of, say, 10 different jigsaw puzzles all mixed together and you didn't have any picture to start with? It'd be a pretty big mess trying to sort out all those pieces and get them together in the right picture, wouldn't it? Well, that's sort of the problem the paleontologists have. That is, these scientists that study fossils, particularly the dinosaur fossils. They have to dig these bones out and then try to put them together in the right dinosaur. Now, one thing that helps them in this respect is the fact that sometimes they find a fossil of a dinosaur, just one dinosaur, all by itself. And maybe it's nearly complete. Now, of course, sometimes they find a single bone or a few bones of a dinosaur, but sometimes they find a nearly complete skeleton, fossilized skeleton of a dinosaur. And so they know that those particular bones go with that particular dinosaur. Now, if they have a picture like this, you see, or a mesh like this, they may know that this particular bone goes with a brontosaurus, this particular bone goes with stegosaurus, and so forth. So they can kind of work it out that way. But it takes a lot of patience. They have to dig these fossilized bones out of the rocks. They transport them to the museum, and there they spend weeks and even months removing the matrix, the rocky material in which we find these fossilized bones, and they clean them up and then try to reassemble them into the dinosaur to get some idea what the dinosaur may have looked like. And they can get a pretty good idea of what these dinosaurs look like from the fossil bones. Now, of course, they don't know what the hide looked like or what the color was. In rare instances, they've actually found the imprint of the hide in the rock, so they get some idea in some cases what that may have looked like. And from this information, then, they can reassemble these things and sort of reconstruct what they may have looked like. And here we see what may have happened on some ancient shore where we have various kinds of dinosaurs. This is what the scientists believe may have existed sometime in the past. Now, we want to take a look at these various kinds of dinosaurs. Here is the phylogenetic tree, what's called a phylogenetic tree of dinosaurs. Now, this is the idea of some evolutionists, how dinosaurs are related. And they start with one particular dinosaur, and they branch out into the various kinds of dinosaurs, the plated dinosaurs, the horned dinosaurs, the duck-billed dinosaurs, and the big plant eaters, and all of that. Now, you see, if this were truly, if they really, truly had an evolutionary tree of dinosaurs along the trunk and the branches, they would have the transitional form, the intermediate types, you see, showing horns gradually evolving, showing jaws and teeth gradually changing into duck bills and all of this sort of thing. That's what we must have if evolution is true. But what we have among the dinosaurs is what we see throughout the fossil record. Each one of these unique type of dinosaurs appears fully formed right at the start, as we will see. There's no evidence that they gradually evolved from some ordinary reptile or from some different kind of dinosaur. And that is what we must find, you see, if evolution is true. Well, let's look at some of these different kinds of dinosaurs. We believe this is the way God made them, and that's why they do appear fully formed. Here we have Triceratops. Now, Triceratops means three-horned face. This dinosaur had one horn above each eye and one horn in the snout. He is a three-horned dinosaur. Notice he also have a huge bony armor shield. That bony armor shield was several inches thick, protecting his neck and his flanks. Now we have different kinds of horned dinosaurs. There are one horned dinosaur. There are five horned dinosaurs, seven horned dinosaurs, various kinds of horned dinosaurs. And if they evolved, as evolutionists believe, we should start with some ordinary reptile or dinosaur, maybe with little knobbies up there on his head. And then these knobbies finally got longer and longer and longer through millions of years of time until we had the Triceratops. Well, then, if that were true, we'd ought to have some fossils of the intermediates. Well, we've never found such a thing. These horned dinosaurs appear fully formed right at the start. Now, here's Stegosaurus. Now, notice Stegosaurus has no horns on the head, but notice that he had four spikes on the tail. And he had those unusual plates that run along the neck, the back, and the tail. Now, we don't know what those plates were used for. Some suggested they may have been armor plate. I doubt that very much. Some have suggested they may have been heat exchangers, absorbing heat from the sun on a cool day and radiating heat on a warm day. That may have been the case. We really don't know. But we do know they were very unusual. The spikes were about 3 feet long, about 6 inches at the base. The plates were quite substantial. Now, would you not agree that if this dinosaur evolved, beginning with some ordinary reptile, that we ought to have some intermediates showing some little knobbies on the tail, gradually evolving, becoming longer and longer and longer till we have these four spikes? We ought to have something on the back and tail gradually be evolving into those plates. We ought to have some of the intermediates, but we don't have one. Not even one. Stegosaurus appears in the fossil record as Stegosaurus. And we have also the duck-billed dinosaur. This is Trachodon. Trachodon stood about 18 feet high. He had a swimming tail. He had webbed feet. He evidently spent a lot of time in the water, a lot of time on land. And he had that very unusual duck bill. And with a very substantial structure, as we can see. And you would have think that surely if this thing evolved, that big duck bill evolved from ordinary jaws and teeth, we'd have a series of transitional forms showing the evolution of this thing. Well, we have many different kinds of duck-billed dinosaurs. This is Corythosaurus. I guess we call him old Bonehead. Probably at the foot of the class. Now, he had noticed that the duck-billed dinosaurs did have teeth, but the teeth were in the back of the bill. And many of these duck-billed dinosaurs had very unusual structures. Here's Paraceralopus. Why, that's very unique. That's very different. If these things evolve, we ought to have a series of transitional forms showing the duck bill gradually coming into existence and that long crest there gradually evolving, you see, something like that. But not one such intermediate has ever been found. Not even one. Now, in this slide, we see... Well, I do declare, that's not a dinosaur, is it? I really didn't intend to show that. I don't know how that slide got in there. It's a picture of my grandson. Real cute little fellow, isn't he? Well, back to the dinosaurs. Here's another real handsome fellow, old Pachycephalosaurus, with those little knobbies, you know, on the nose there and back of the head. Oh, we ought to have some intermediates, but not one has ever been found. Then we have the meat eaters. This is Allosaurus. Now, we can't be sure that he ate meat. We weren't there to see what he ate. We could just say he seemed to be, he simply was equipped for it. Now, he could have been eating fruit, for all we know. A gorilla has very fierce teeth. It looks like a gorilla would eat meat, but he doesn't. He's a herbivore. He never eats meat. Fruit-eating bats have some very ferocious-looking teeth. They just eat fruit. But in any case, it is assumed that these creatures ate meat. And then we have the largest one of all, the great Tyrannosaurus rex. Tyrannosaurus rex had jaws 6 feet long and teeth 6 inches long. Oh, I don't know about you. I'm glad that critter is extinct. Wouldn't want something like that walking around today. Well, you and I would hardly make a mid-afternoon snack for this great creature, this great Tyrannosaurus rex. No wonder they call them dinosaurs. Dinosaur means terrible lizard. And indeed, he was a terrible lizard. Then we have the great plant-eating dinosaurs. Notice the man standing in front of this 100-foot-long dinosaur. This is Diplodocus. Diplodocus means double-beamed. He was double-beamed indeed, with that long neck and that long tail, stretching out 100 feet. Then we have the great thunder lizard, Brontosaurus. Brontosaurus means thunder lizard. Now, we understand we're not supposed to call him Brontosaurus anymore. The story is this. Some fossil hunter found a dinosaur and called him Apatosaurus. Sometime later, another fossil hunter found another dinosaur, and some distance away he found a skull, and he assumed this skull went on the dinosaur, and when he put that skull on the dinosaur, it was different than the Apatosaurus. He named it Brontosaurus. Brontosaurus means thunder lizard. He assumed the ground must have thundered, you see, when Brontosaurus went by. He weighed about 40 tons, about 80,000 pounds, and was, 80, 90 feet long, something like that. Well, later on, it was discovered that this fellow had put the wrong skull on Brontosaurus. And when they got the right skull on it, it was the same as the Apatosaurus. So we're supposed to change the name and call him Apatosaurus. But I still like this name, Brontosaurus, Thunder Lizard. And everybody remembers him as Brontosaurus. So I still call him Brontosaurus with that qualification. Now, he was not the largest dinosaur of all. The largest dinosaur of all was Brachiosaurus. Brachiosaurus stood as high as a 5-story building, up to 50 feet high. He weighed up to 100 tons, or 200,000 pounds, a massive plant-eating dinosaur. And you know, he had a most unusual anatomy. His nostrils were not located out on the end of the snout, but in a bony dome on the top of the head. Now, no one has ever been able to figure out why he had that strange anatomy. Some have suggested, you know, various ideas, but none seem to be compelling. Well, we just don't know why he had that strange anatomy. But this one thing we do know. We've never found a series of transition forms showing the nostrils migrating gradually into the bony dome on the top of the head. Nothing like that has been found. Right from the start, Brachiosaurus is Brachiosaurus, with the nostrils in the bony dome on the top of the head. And that's true of all of these other dinosaurs. I've traveled around the world and visited many of the great museums, the London Museum and the British Natural History Museum in London. The last time I was there, they had a very good exhibit of dinosaurs from China. I visited the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh, American Museum in New York, the Los Angeles Natural History Museum, the Denver Museum, which has a very fine exhibit of dinosaurs. I have seen fossils of many, many different kinds of dinosaurs. But one thing I have not seen is one single transitional form showing a dinosaur gradually coming into existence. Now, if you visited these museums, you may have seen a fossil of Stegosaurus or Brontosaurus or one of these other creatures, but you've never seen any transitional form, have you? I mean, there they are, complete at the start. Now, you see, that is powerful, positive evidence for creation. What else could we as creationists expect to find what we do find in the fossil record? On the other hand, evolution would require the existence of these transitional forms. If one creature did actually change into another, what would be the evidence for that? The actual existence of the intermediate, the transitional form showing that one creature did change into another. But that is what we cannot find. We do not see that here among the dinosaurs. It is just as true here as we see throughout the fossil record. Each basic type, each distinctive kind appears fully formed, without a trace of an ancestor, with no intermediates, you see. That is because God created those creatures just as we see them. Well, if God created them, why don't we have dinosaurs today? Why don't they exist today? Well, you know, scientists have given all kinds of notions of why dinosaurs became extinct. One scientist suggested that perhaps after the mammals evolved, they ate all the dinosaur eggs, ate up all the dinosaur eggs and killed off the dinosaur. Another suggested perhaps there's some unusual disease came into the world that just affected dinosaurs and wiped out the dinosaur. And believe me now, I'm not kidding. One scientist suggested the reason dinosaurs became extinct, there was a change in plant types of some kind. The dinosaurs were no longer able to digest these plants, and they died of constipation. Actually, seriously, that's what one scientist suggested. Now, today, the more popular theory is this, is that an asteroid struck the Earth and flung so much dust into the air, it blanketed out the Earth for several years. And as a result, the plants died off. And then, of course, the plant-eating dinosaurs died. And then, of course, the meat-eating dinosaurs died. Fact is, I just heard a comment on radio just yesterday where they've discovered a great crater, they believe, down in Mexico, 100 miles across, something like that, a huge crater, they believe, was left by an asteroid that struck the Earth. That has been suggested. Well, maybe, but you know, there's some real serious problems with those ideas. None of them seem to hold up in view of all the facts. Let's just think about this idea of an asteroid striking the Earth and blanketing out the Earth, causing a worldwide catastrophe that destroyed all the dinosaurs. It'd have to be a worldwide catastrophe because dinosaurs all over the world died out. Well, if an asteroid struck the Earth and blanketed out the Earth and killed off all the dinosaurs, why didn't it kill off the birds? How could the birds survive if this were true? Why didn't it kill off all the thin-skinned mammals? How did they survive? How did birds and mammals survive all this and the dinosaurs? From the little fellows up to very big fellows. Because some of these dinosaurs were hardly bigger than chicken. Some weighed up to 100 tons. And there are many different kinds of dinosaurs living off various kinds of food. If it killed off all of those creatures over the entire earth, how did the birds survive? How did mammals survive? And why at the same time did other creatures, very different from the dinosaur, die out worldwide? You see, it doesn't fit. Well, you may ask, what do I think caused the extinction of the dinosaurs? Well, I have to admit I wasn't there. I didn't see what happened. But I think we can form a pretty good idea if we take the Bible seriously, if we take science seriously. The Bible tells us that at the time of the flood, it rained very hard for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, that could not happen today. There's not enough water vapor in the atmosphere to give more than 1 to 2 inches of rain if it rained over the entire surface of the earth and would distribute it evenly, you see. That's all the water vapor we have. Once that has happened, then the atmosphere would be bone dry. That means then at the time of the flood, there was much, much more water vapor in the atmosphere than there is today. Now, that water vapor came down at the time of the flood. That would have contributed only a part of the water at the time of the flood, the eruption of the great subterranean reservoirs, the uplift of the ocean floors, the dropping of the continental floors, which flood the earth, you see. Many causes would have contributed, but certainly there was this vast deluge. Now, only a fraction of that water vapor has returned to the atmosphere. Conditions have changed drastically, and only a fraction of that water vapor has returned to the atmosphere. Now, if these facts are true, and we certainly believe that they are true, that means there was much, much more water vapor in the atmosphere at the time of the flood than there is today. Well, how would that affect the earth? How would that affect our climate? Well, there are three gases in the atmosphere today that are responsible for absorbing and retaining solar heat. Those three gases are carbon dioxide, ozone, and water vapor. Of those three gases, water vapor is by far the most important. Now, if we had much, much more water vapor before the flood than today, this would create what is commonly called a greenhouse effect. That would absorb and retain much more solar heat than the present atmosphere. This would create then this greenhouse effect and would give the Earth a worldwide mild climate. Now those conditions changed drastically at the time of the flood. Today we have the very cold Arctic, the very cold Antarctic. We have vast desert areas and so forth. Very, very different than a worldwide mild climate with lush vegetation covering the Earth. Under these circumstances, apparently, the dinosaurs failed to repopulate the Earth following the flood. They just died out. Just as today, there are many species that are becoming extinct, and many more would if we were not making heroic efforts to sustain these various species. Now, you might ask, well, is there physical evidence for this? Do you have some evidence outside of the Bible? Very definitely. I mentioned the fact that we found a variety of fossils of dinosaurs on the north shore of Alaska and down in Antarctica. You see, the evolutionist, he doesn't know how it's possible that dinosaurs could exist on the north shore of Alaska or in Antarctica. He is at a loss to explain that. But if what we are seeing were true, and we had this worldwide mild climate, then of course dinosaurs could exist up in Alaska or down in Antarctica. We find, as a matter of fact, fossils of animals at every latitude, plant and animals at every latitude, some of now which live only in the tropics, some of which now live only in temperate zones and other zones. We know that Greenland at one time had a climate very similar to the Caribbean. It has had a lush subtropical climate. We find fossils of palm trees and ferns and things like that on Greenland. Greenland today, of course, is covered perpetually with ice and snow. So we've had a tremendous change in climate on the Earth, and the evolutionary geologists say they do not know why these changes have occurred. Even if all the continents were part of one massive continent, as some geologists believe today, you still, under present-day circumstances, you would have climatic zones, a very cold, temperate, and tropical zone, which we don't have. So something had to account for that change. We believe that was the flood. Now, that would have caused then the extinction of the dinosaurs. Worldwide, you see, because they failed to repopulate the Earth. I think when we take the Bible seriously, we take the facts of science seriously and put them all together, we can work out some of these problems which otherwise defy an explanation. So we see that dinosaurs created by God, each kind appears fully formed right at the start, just as the creationists would expect if God had created them, certainly does not produce the evidence that the theory of evolution would require. Now, I want to mention another creature that's described in the 41st chapter of Job. I mentioned the dinosaurs, that is, the behemoth mentioned in the 40th chapter of Job. In the 41st chapter, we read about an even more unusual creature. We read about a creature called the Leviathan. Apparently spent time in the water because it said you cannot lower down a hook and catch this creature. And it says that he defies arrows and spears and things like that, which are the instruments we use on land. So he must have spent time in the water, time in the land. But the most unusual feature of this creature was the fact that he breathed fire. The Bible tells us here that in verse 19 of the 41st chapter of Job, out of his mouth go burning lamps and sparks of fire leap out. We read, out of his nostrils goes smoke as out of a seething pot or cauldron. His breath kindles coals and a flame goes out of his mouth. Now, what does that sound like? Well, the only thing that I know of that fits that description is a dragon. But now, wait a minute. Dragons are just mythological. We know that they never existed. They're just a myth, you know. Well, I don't believe so. The Bible here is speaking of a real creature. This is not poetry. It's not allegory. It's speaking of something that really did exist. Dragons. Now, furthermore, all around the world, we find legends of dragons. Of course, the Chinese had theirs. There's all the people, the Indians here in America and other places have stories of dragons. The last time I was in Israel, we visited Jordan. And when we were in Jordan, we visited the Church of St. George. And in that church, on the wall, was a huge mural showing St. George killing a dragon. So that story, from that part of the country, you see in many different parts of the country, of the world, we find these stories about dragons. Now, when we have a legend as widespread as that, generally people assume it must have resulted from something that really did happen. Various diverse people all over the world never had contact with each other, had these similar stories. So we believe then, based upon what the Scripture tells us, based upon what we learn in other places, there must have been a creature such as a dragon. But how could a dragon do that? What would be the mechanism, you see, that where it could breathe fire? Is that possible? Is there some mechanism or some means to do that? Well, I want to tell you the story of the bombardier beetle. I think the bombardier beetle might give us a little hint, a little suggestion of how that might have happened. Here we see a bombardier beetle. Now, don't worry, he's really not that big. He's only about a half an inch long. But this bombardier beetle has a most unusual defense mechanism. When a predator or an enemy of some kind gets just in the right position, pow, you hear an audible pop, and hot gases heated to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, as hot as boiling water, pours out of twin combustion tubes in the tail of that bombardier beetle right in the face of his enemy. And furthermore, that hot gas that pours out of the twin combustion tubes has a irritating chemical in it, something very noxious and irritating. And you can imagine what would happen if something like that went off in your face, hot as boiling water, containing this irritating chemical. And that bombardier beetle has some muscles. He can swivel those tubes around in any direction, and he never misses. Here we see the bombardier beetle. I notice the scientist is tightening down so he can't move. Now he's pinching his legs with a pair of forceps. Notice the bombardier beetle has swiveled those combustion tubes downward, point them right at that irritant, and boom, he let him have it. Now, here we see a frog looking at the bombardier beetle. Now, you know what that frog is thinking, don't you? That frog is thinking, there's my lunch. But now you know what the bombardier beetle is thinking. He's thinking, I'm not going to provide lunch for that silly old toad. Well, let's see what happens. Here we see the toad just getting ready to grab the bombardier beetle, but the bombardier beetle swiveled those combustion tubes around, pointed them right in the mouth of the toad, and pow, he let him have it. Those hot gases containing that irritating chemical pours right into the mouth of the toad. The results are perfectly predictable. Here we see the toad backpedaling as fast as he can go. His tongue is hanging out. He's gagging. His eyes are popping out. He's had it. He wants nothing more to do with that silly old bombardier beetle. He's had enough of that, and he's getting out of there as fast as he can. But notice the bombardier beetle. Not to worry. He's just walking away as calmly as can be. No problem. Doesn't have to worry about that old toad anymore. You see, the toad's not going to bother him. Now, when scientists see something like this, they get very curious. How would a bombardier beetle do that? Well, they sharpened up their little microsurgical tools, and they dissected these bombardier beetles, and I don't know how many they had to squish to get enough juice to work out the chemistry, but they worked it all out. Now, what they found was that the bombardier beetle has twin sets of apparatus. It has twin storage chambers and twin combustion tubes. And on those combustion tubes, he has a valve on the end. It can release just at the right time. He has muscles, you know, in his belly. Can you swivel those combustion tubes around in all directions? And they discover that in those two storage chambers, he stores a mixture of chemicals. Two chemicals, hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone. Hydrogen peroxide is a chemical water molecule with an extra oxygen, which it can donate to oxidize the chemical. The chemical that gets oxidized is hydroquinone. Hydroquinone gets oxidized to quinone. quinone is the irritating chemical. Now what happens? You see, the bombardier beetle stores these two chemicals, a mixture of these two chemicals, in his storage chamber. Now, one of the first unusual things about this is that if you and I would go in the laboratory and we'd mix up hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone, the hydrogen peroxide slowly would oxidize the hydroquinone. After a while, we have a mess, dirty, black-looking mess. But you see, the bombardier beetle, he's a smart chemist. He stores these two chemicals, but he adds an inhibitor. This inhibitor prevents this chemical reaction. And it's a very complicated chemical. It's a protein, very complicated in structure, precisely designed to do one thing and do one thing only, and that's to prevent this chemical reaction. So the solution just sits there and remains perfectly clear, clear as water, just crystal clear. No chemical reaction of any kind. But then when he is threatened by an enemy, he squirts this solution into the combustion tubes, and there the reaction occurs explosively, almost instantaneously. Now, how can that be true? They just sit there and nothing happens. When it gets in the combustion tube, the reaction is so rapid, it's almost explosive. Creates a lot of, and the thing gets real hot. It generates all that heat and all that pressure. Then the bombardier beetle releases that valve just at the right time after he's pointed those combustion tubes in the right direction. Pow! He's taking care of his enemy. How does that happen? Well, in those combustion tubes, the bombardier beetle has two enzymes. Now, what are enzymes? Well, enzymes are those marvelous things we have in our bodies which cause chemical reactions to go very rapid, which ordinarily would go slowly. Now, life cannot exist without enzymes. The most primitive living cell that one could imagine would have to have hundreds of different kinds of enzymes to make all of these chemical reactions which are necessary for life to go rapidly. If you eat your lunch, you can't wait for weeks and months for that food to break down. You need that energy right now. You need that food, the benefit of the food right now. So you have many different kinds of digestive enzymes in your digestive system that breaks down that food in just seconds, in minutes. Well, this bombardier beetle has two of those enzymes in those combustion tubes. One is called catalase. Catalase is an enzyme that catalyzes a very rapid breakdown of hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen. That provides the oxygen to oxidize the hydroquinone, and it provides excess oxygen that is responsible for the high pressure. Then there's another enzyme called peroxidase. Peroxidase is an enzyme that catalyzes a very, very rapid oxidation of hydroquinone into quinone. So the reaction occurs explosively. The inhibitor no longer is effective in the presence of these two enzymes. The reaction occurs almost instantaneously, creates all that heat and all that pressure. The valve is released just at the right time, and bingo, he's right on target. Now, how did a bombardier beetle come into existence? Well, now, we as creationists believe God created him. But the evolutionists say, no, he just evolved. He started as an ordinary beetle, and over, well, maybe a few million years, he gradually evolved into the bombardier beetle through a series of genetic mistakes. We call them mutations. Just accident, just mistake. That's what he believes. Why? Tremendous faith these people must have. Let us try to imagine how this may have taken place. Will you allow me a little poetic license? Let us assume that millions of years ago, there was this little beetle. We'll call him Beetle Bailey. And one day, his mom and dad gave him a chemistry set for his birthday. And sometime later, down in his chemistry lab in the basement, and he thought, I wonder what will happen if I mix up hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone and put in these two enzymes. I wonder what would happen. So he dissolves these two chemicals. Then he throws in the two enzymes and he rams the stopper down on the flask. All of a sudden, boom, the thing blows up and just splatters him all over the wall of the lab. Poor little Beetle Bailey. Now, the first problem is this. Little Beetle Bailey can't warn his offspring. Little Beetle shouldn't do such things. Because obviously he doesn't have any offspring. And so I don't know, maybe for few million years, boom, 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 boom. Little beetles are just blowing themselves up. You see, he got to know that you put the two chemicals over here in the storage chamber and you keep those two enzymes over here until you're ready for action, you see. And another thing he's got to know is that you've got to add an inhibitor. That's essential too. Now, how would he know that? How would he, just by accident, would he invent the storage chamber? Why would he invent a storage chamber? Why would evolution invent that until you had the two chemicals? What would you need the storage chamber for? On the other hand, what would you need the two chemicals before you had the storage chamber and the inhibitor, you see? All right, let us dispose by some accident or bunch of accidents. He finally gets the storage chamber and he gets those two chemicals and the inhibitor. So what? What evolutionary advantage would that be? It wouldn't do nothing to sit there and soak and sour and corrode his innards, something like that. He couldn't use it for any earthly good. You see, he doesn't have his combustion tube. That hasn't been invented yet. That has not even evolved yet, you see. What good would it do? What evolutionary advantage would that have? He's got to have those combustion tubes. But wait a minute. Why would he evolve? Why would those combustion tubes evolve until he had the storage chamber and the two chemicals and the inhibitor? Why would one come before the other? It couldn't happen just boom like that, you see. It'd have to go step by step by step by step through a series of genetic mistakes. How could that be worked out? Step by step by step and still function and actually be superior to the preceding state. And those combustion tubes have to be very, very special. They have to be able to contain that high pressure and that very hot temperature. What if you had something in your tummy at 212 degrees Fahrenheit? It'd cook you in a minute, wouldn't it? And what if you had all that gas in there? Blow your tummy apart. Why, those combustion tubes have to be very, very special. They have to resist that high temperature. They have to resist that irritating chemical. They have to contain that high pressure. And remember this, the bombardier beetle didn't have any ceramics. He didn't have any metal. He just had ordinary old beetle stuff. Now, if you were an engineer and you had to work out something like that, you could probably do it, but not if you had just ordinary old beetle stuff. You wouldn't know where to start. You wouldn't know how to do it. But the beetle has that just made out of beetle stuff. He's got those very special combustion tubes. Well, how can that happen? Would there be a series of genetic mistakes that could create something like that? Isn't it incredible what an unbeliever must believe in order to be an unbeliever? It really is incredible to think something like that just happened. Well, let us suppose by some great miracle of some kind or other, we had a beetle with the storage chamber, the two chemicals, the inhibitor, the combustion tubes, the valve, the muscles, and all of that. And you say, wow, here we are. We are the bombardier beetle. Just a moment. Not quite. Something vitally important is missing. And that is his communications network. He hasn't worked that out yet. That hasn't evolved. Why, you know, that could be very embarrassing. Supposing his friend Joe Beetle came up and pat him on the back and said, hi, friend, boom, right in the face of his friend Joe Beetle. That could be embarrassing. You could lose a lot of friends that way. And you wouldn't take care of your enemy. You see, you have to have a communication network complete. You have to give the signal to squirt it into the combustion tube. You have to release the enzyme. You have to keep that valve until it's released just at the right time. You have to be able to activate those muscles and all of that. You have to have that. Now, the problem is this. Nothing works until everything works. And imagine that this came about by a series of genetic mistakes. You know, we put a spacecraft on Mars, didn't we? Why did we put a spacecraft on Mars? Because nothing was left to chance. But in the evolutionary view, the origin of bombardier beetle, everything was left to chance. You'd never get there. You see, you couldn't get there. No, the bombardier beetle is not the result of chance. He was created by the master engineer. But what does this have to do with dragons? Well, I'm just suggesting this, that if the bombardier beetle, little old bombardier beetle, could do that, what about these dinosaurs that had hollow domes on the top of their head with twin channels going down to their mouth? You know, a variety of dinosaurs had things just like that. Hollow domes on the top of their head, twin channels going down to the mouth. Nobody's ever been able to figure out what they used it for. Now, I'm just suggesting they may have had a chemical or a mixture of chemical stored in those hollow domes, which they squirted out of their mouth, which, when these chemicals contacted the oxygen of the air, they would spontaneously burst into flame. As a matter of fact, in my research at the Upjohn Company, when I was there, I worked with a chemical that would do that. One of the intermediates in the synthesis that I was performing would do that. If I'd allow some of it to escape my apparatus, it would spontaneously burst into flame. So there are chemicals that do that. And I'm just suggesting, I don't know, I wasn't there, that these dragons had a mixture of chemicals or a chemical in those hollow domes, which, when sprayed out into the air and contacted the oxygen of the air, would burst into flame. Now, you see, again, when we take the facts of science, take the Bible seriously. Don't try to brush it aside or make excuses for it or say, well, you know, maybe we got some fancy stories mixed in there, something like that, myth and so forth and so on. When we take the Bible seriously, when we take our science then and put the two together, we can reach some conclusions that the evolutionist, the unbeliever, he'd never reach the right conclusion because he's begun with the wrong set of assumptions. Assuming that there is no supernatural, there is no creator, you see, he must try to invent a natural explanation for everything. Now, as scientists, certainly, we believe that we must use natural laws and processes to explain the operation of the universe and living organisms, to explain the operation of the bombardier beetle. All we need is natural laws and processes. But how do you explain the origin of the bombardier beetle? How do you explain the origin of the universe or the origin of living organisms, including people? The evolution says we have to use those same natural laws and processes. No, that's where he's wrong, you see. You can explain the operation of a watch using only the laws of physics. That can be done. But you cannot explain the origin of the watch using the laws of physics, can you? No, you must believe, and we do believe, there is a watchmaker, an intelligent creator, you see. And the bombardier beetle is vastly more complex than a watch. It could not have created itself by natural processes. Therefore, it must have been created, you see, supernaturally. Therefore, we look at dinosaurs, their nature and their origin, the bombardier beetle, its nature and origin. Then once again, we must say that the best explanation that we can give for the origin of these creatures is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and all that it contains. Thank you very much.